Our next speaker is going to be Lessons from Outside the Surgery, How Others Work to Achieve Parity. We asked Ms. Siri Chalazi, who is an MBA, MPA from the Harvard Kennedy School, to come and speak to us. She's a research fellow at the Women in Public Policy Program at the Harvard John F. Kennedy School of Government. She's a recognized expert in advancing women and promoting gender equality within organizations. So thank you, Ms. Chalazi.
Good morning, everybody. It's a real pleasure to be here, and I'm delighted to be able to share some evidence-based practices from other organizations from across industries that help us drive gender parity. And I'm delighted to report that I have no conflicts. Before we get to some of those evidence-based practices, though, I want to start with one of the key barriers that's really preventing us from getting to equality today. There's many barriers, of course, but I want to tackle unconscious bias for two reasons. The first is that it impacts every single one of us individually. It also, number two, impacts every single system and organization and department and team, regardless of the industry. I'm sure many of you are familiar with the concept of unconscious bias, but I'll still ask you to take a quick look at this checkerboard, if you will, please, and decide what color squares A and B are. And as I quickly cover up the rest of the board, keep your eyes on squares A and B. So what color are they? I'm seeing some confused faces, so I'll go back to convince you that I'm not playing tricks on you. In fact, it's your own mind playing a trick on itself. So this right here is unconscious bias in action. We're bombarded with so much information all the time that we have to resort to patterns, to heuristics, to make sense of all of that information. And while, of course, there's nothing inherently wrong with pattern-based thinking, it can often lead us astray, just like it does here. The checkerboard pattern is so familiar and so overpowering that your brain is quite simply unable to do justice to squares A and B and to see them for what they really are. The other really important aspect of unconscious bias that the checkerboard illustrates is that even once you know you have it, it's incredibly difficult to overcome its effects. So I'm guessing that most of you looking at this now still see square A as being darker than square B, right? And I do too. I've seen this 5,000 times. And we need some change to the external environment, some intervention, which in this case is the addition of the white blinders, to liberate our mind from the pattern and to allow us to see these squares for what they really are. So we'll return to this concept in just a moment, but I first want to introduce you to Heidi Roizen, because in real life, of course, bias most often shows up in our interactions with people and not in our observations of checkerboards. So Heidi Roizen is a very successful venture capitalist and entrepreneur in Silicon Valley, and she was the protagonist of a case study that some colleagues of mine at Harvard Business School wrote in the year 2000. But what's most interesting for us is that a few years after that, colleagues at Columbia Business School did an experiment using this case study. They gave half of their students the original case with Heidi's name on it, and the other half of the students got the identical case study, but with Heidi's name swapped out for Howard. And then before the students came into class, after they'd read the case study, they surveyed the students about their perceptions of Heidi and Howard, and this is what they found. You won't be surprised, or you shouldn't be surprised, to hear that the students actually found Heidi and Howard equally competent. Don't forget, they're the same person doing all the same stuff. So they should be viewed as equally competent. But sadly, they were not viewed as equally likable. When the same set of behaviors was displayed by Heidi, those same behaviors were viewed as more self-promoting, more disingenuous, and more power-hungry than when those exact same behaviors were being displayed by a man called Howard. So the key message here, the takeaway, is that we humans are very bad at evaluating other people objectively, but we're also very bad at evaluating other people's behavior objectively. When the exact same set of behaviors comes from a woman or from a man, it has a different effect, and we perceive it differently. That's what we're up against, and this is how we've been traditionally dealing with it. Companies in the United States spend about $8 billion a year on various types of diversity trainings or diversity inclusion initiatives, which tend to take the form of trainings, mentorship and sponsored programs, and networking events. The only problem with all of this is that research shows that it does not work. And one of the key reasons why it does not work is that these type of approaches are aimed at changing individual hearts and minds. This is what Caprice was talking about when she was saying fix the women instead of fix the system. This is about fixing individuals. But the fact of the matter is that unconscious bias is built not only into our individual minds, but it's also built into the systems and the processes and the environments that we biased humans have created. And the good news in all of this is that while debiasing individual minds is incredibly difficult to do, in fact, might be impossible, best as we know by today's research, it does turn out that debiasing processes and systems is actually quite possible. And the way to do that is through behavioral design. Behavioral design builds on decades of research from fields like behavioral economics, social psychology, neurology, that tells us about how the human brain works. And it helps us take all those insights into account to design environments and systems that help our inherently biased, our inherently imperfect minds get it right and make better decisions. One example of this in the context of gender parity specifically is the U.S. orchestras, which started out in the early 1970s as only 5% female. And over the course of the next four decades or so leading up to today, they transformed from 5% female to 40% female today. That's an astonishing transformation. And the main driver, the main reason, or the main way the orchestras accomplished this was by adding a blind curtain into the audition process, so that the evaluating orchestra directors could only hear the music that was played, but they couldn't see the musicians. And that helped take some unconscious bias out of the process because it allowed the orchestra directors to focus on what was really important, and it liberated their minds from any patterns that they may have had about what a good orchestra musician looks like or not. So now I want to get to some of those research evidence-based practices that have been deployed with great success across many organizations, industries, and fields. And we'll start with language. This is an example of a real job advertisement for a kindergarten teacher. And you'll notice that I've italicized some of those words. It turns out that language is gendered. And in our cultural context in the United States, words like warm and caring and supportive are distinctly female-typed. But it goes a little bit further than that, because it turns out that this job advertisement will attract a disproportionate number of female applicants to apply for the job. Likewise, if you were Google, let's say, and you were recruiting an aggressive and individualistic coding ninja, guess who's going to be more likely to apply for that job, a man or a woman? So the fix is actually quite simple. You could simply take out those explicitly gendered words and replace them with neutral concepts, as in this example. The other option you could balance out female and male-coded words. And there's actually software out there that will help you do it. Some of it's free open source, and some are software solutions that you have to pay for. But they're amazing. They help you flag gendered language and replace it as you go along. I do want to point out, and I think it was Sherry who mentioned this, that gendered language shows up anywhere and everywhere that language is used. So not just job advertisements, but also letters of recommendation, also performance evaluations, also in write-ups of people's work and how women and men's work is described. It's not equal. So then we get to recruitment and hiring, which was one of those organizational processes that has a ton of unnecessary unconscious bias built into it. This is one of the few places in organizations that are not orchestras where it's feasible to implement a blinding approach. So with great success and backed by a lot of research, blinding resumes or other written application materials, which means we take people's names off, other demographic information off, sometimes we even take off the names of past educational institutions or employers, really helps prevent unnecessary unconscious bias from seeping into the process. Because if you think about it, what information does a person's name contain that helps you judge their competence on the job? The only purpose that the name serves is to potentially trigger gender biases, to potentially trigger racial or ethnic biases. But it really has no bearing on the person's competence on the job. Another really successful intervention in the realm of recruitment and hiring is structured interviews that were also mentioned earlier. And in case some of you are not familiar, the idea is that every single candidate for a given position gets asked the same questions in the same order, and the interviewer evaluates the responses as they go along, instead of waiting until all the way at the end of the interview to form kind of a nebulous overall assessment. And then when you're comparing the candidates against each other, you want to look across one question at a time. So let's take everyone's answer to question one, who answered it best, then question two. And that way you're really able to calibrate the candidates against each other as best as possible. But I want to add one more thing under recruitment, because as much as we love interviews and as much as we're married to using them, there's decades-old research that shows quite convincingly that they're actually the least predictive evaluation method. Interviews are just very bad at gauging people's competence on the job. What works much better is something we call work sample tests, and they're quite simply tasks that are designed to mirror the actual job as closely as possible. So if you're hiring a physician, might it be possible, instead of talking to them about how they practice medicine, to just see them in action practicing medicine and evaluate them that way? Or once again, if I'm Google and I'm hiring a coder, instead of talking to someone about how they write code, could I just have them write a piece of code and then evaluate the quality of that code? These work sample tests, today, given the methodologies that we have available to us, are shown to be the most predictive instrument of hiring. I want to talk a little bit more about evaluations and broaden the context, not just from the hiring process, but anytime really you're evaluating people. This could be for promotions, this could be for special stretch assignments, or it could be for compensation or bonus decisions, for example. Our human minds work comparatively. So how hot or cold you feel right now has something to do with the previous place that you came in. Were you outside? Were you in a different room? And what was the temperature of that place compared to here? And our minds also gravitate to comparative evaluations with people. It turns out that if we only have one person in front of us and there's no obvious point of reference or point of comparison, we pull an imaginary reference point from our brain because we need to make a comparative evaluation. And most often that prototype or that stereotypical picture of success who we pull up as a reference point is much less diverse than what we want the world to be going forward. And so what we are in essence asking when we're evaluating individuals one at a time is, does this person look like all the people who have been successful in this role in the past? And so a simple way to get around this, I don't want to call it a cognitive deficiency, but it's a cognitive fact of life of how our brains work, is to make evaluations, to make decisions jointly and simultaneously. Instead of hiring one person in March and one person in June and one person in November, could you hire for all three open positions at the same time and now compare all of these candidates against each other? So you have this point of comparison in the big group. Same thing if you're making decisions about promotion or evaluating people for some stretch assignment like the leadership of a task force or a committee. The more we can make decisions simultaneously in bundles, the more diversity emerges in our decision making. This has been shown both in a laboratory environment, in an experimental setting, but also in the field. One of the key elements to promoting gender parity is the power of role models and symbols. Role models in the traditional sense of people who you can look up to are incredibly important, but I actually want to talk about role models in a slightly different sense. This picture comes from my own institution, the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, where we discovered a couple years ago that we had exactly zero pictures of women up on our walls. And for those of you who aren't familiar with my institution, we have a lot of pictures of a lot of people up on the walls. And exactly zero were of women. That was not a conscious omission, of course. It was totally unwitting. But what we were communicating to both the women and the men in our community was that women's leadership and accomplishments aren't as worthy of being celebrated and recognized as men's leadership and accomplishments are. And we count among our alumni people like, what's her name? The former president of Liberia on the left, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. So we have a lot of female alumni and community members whose leadership and accomplishments are certainly worth celebrating. So when we talk about the power of role models and symbols, it's the pictures on your walls quite physically, absolutely. But it's also the people whose pictures appear in recruitment materials, on your brochures, on your website. It's the people who are the talking heads in the holiday video. It's the folks who come to conferences. It's the people whose work is cited as examples in talks and in informal settings. It's even things like the names of your conference rooms. There are numerous studies that show what big an effect what you see has on what you think is possible. Seeing is believing. And if we never see female surgeons, or if female surgeons' work is never lifted us as an example of the most innovative and cutting-edge work in the field, how could our minds possibly form an association connecting those two things? So seeing is believing, but symbols are also about changing social norms. And when I say social norms, I really mean the shared understandings of what behaviors are expected, but also accepted. So if you look at these two beaches, which one would you be more likely to drop a piece of trash on? The left beach or the right beach? That's the easy question. It's the left, of course. But I think the more interesting question is why? Why do we feel more comfortable dropping a piece of trash on the left beach and the right beach? And this has to do a lot with social norms. Again, those expectations or understandings of what is okay. It's very clear that the norms around littering are very different on these two beaches. So now if you think about your team, your department, your institution, is it more of a dirty beach environment or a clean beach environment? If a colleague gets interrupted in a meeting, what's the response? If someone drops a racist or a sexist joke, what happens? There's very promising research to show that as individuals, we have actually much more power than we realize to shape these social norms, to shape organizational cultures, and to move our work teams from a dirty beach environment to a clean beach environment. Has anyone heard of the concept of micro-sponsorship? Has anyone heard of microaggressions? I'm not going to give you the definition of microaggressions, but I suggest that you read Ron and team's report because there's an excellent section of microaggressions in there. But micro-sponsorship you can think of as the small everyday acts of support that you can provide to colleagues. So it's interrupting the interrupter in a meeting. Or if John mentions a great idea in the meeting that you know Jane actually brought up 5 minutes ago, you can simply say, thank you, John. I love that you built on Jane's excellent idea. Now, how can we make this even better collectively? If someone you think should be on a task force or should be in a meeting is not there, you can raise that issue with the organizer and say, hey, why wasn't that person invited? I think we should really bring her into the fold. These are really small everyday actions that actually have a huge impact on culture and can go a long way in creating more gender equal environments. So just to quickly summarize what we talked about, we discussed gendered language, which is one of the easier things to eliminate. There's various ways of debiasing your talent and hiring processes. I strongly encourage you to employ joint evaluations rather than separate evaluations wherever possible. Each of us can be a role model, particularly through being a micro-sponsor. For those of you who are interested in learning more, I highly recommend my colleague Iris Bennett's book, What Works? Gender Equality by Design. It delves much deeper into all of these topics and has an enormous library of practical interventions that can be deployed in any organization. And with that, I thank you very much for listening, and I look forward to our conversation.